Welcome back to Behind the Play. My name is Alex Adams, and I am joined by someone that I've admired for a long time, already been on the show before, one of the brightest minds in the industry, and my favorite WWE Twitter follow too, that, for a novice, I follow your stuff. But thanks so much to Blake Murphy of Sportsnet for taking the time and doing this. What's up in the WWE world? I need a little lesson right now.
So the big thing, there are two big things, I guess. The big one is there is like a horror-based faction that just debuted recently. So if you've ever heard the name Bray Wyatt, he passed away last year, and his brother has kind of picked up his storytelling and like the horror aspects of his character. So it's kind of like a horror-y slash Bray Wyatt tribute act. Which we'll see how that goes. It's something different at least. And then the other one is there's a huge event in Toronto in early July. So that's why I've been able to have WWE guests on my show recently, Shawn Michaels and Sami Zayn. They got Money in the Bank to promote.
Awesome. I'd imagine you're going to the event.
I don't know.
Okay.
Jay's duties kind of take first precedent. The schedule would allow me to double dip. As long as we're not going into like deep into extra innings, but we'll see.
Well, I hope for your sake that you're able to do that. And I guess with, you were on the Raptors show throughout the season and then go to the Jays. Like, how big of a transition is that for you going from those sports, and just what is that, maybe even that process like too, for to make that transition?
Yeah, it's a lot. I don't want to complain because obviously it's a very cool job regardless, but it's a lot to keep up with two sports at once at the level that I hope and intend to do them at. It's keep even something like there are little costs like I can't be at spring training because I'm doing the Raptors. I'm not locked in on the draft as much as I'd like to be right now because I'm doing Blue Jays. I won't be at training camp because I'll be on Blue Jays, and so there are little things like that. And then the biggest one is, on the Jay show, that's 2 hours a day on one team and I'm riding solo. So from a process wise and like a vibe wise, it's a lot different than doing a show with Will or doing a show with Will and Alex, where the energy and the conversation can carry so much of it. It's fun. It's just a different challenge. And then the nice, easy similarity between the two is that both teams are unbelievably disappointing. So energy wise, I'm in the exact same spot. No transition at all.
There you go. Your energy levels are the same. Is that something where, you talk about like a solo show? Like, has that been a bit of an adjustment just for you to almost like bring, I guess in this case, bring some l lower energy in a sense, but just to do it, do you feel like you have to get more amped, take some more coffee because you're talking a bit more? Like, how does that work?
It's more on the prep side. Like, I'm always gonna just be authentic, and if I mean, you find the energy because it's a fun job, no matter how bad the team is. And, you can find other things to, it's fun to get fired up sometimes and call for Ross Atkins, or it's fun to get fired up because the team's, Vlad's finally hitting for power or whatever it is. So, I would say from a prep standpoint is where the biggest difference is because, like, if you run out of steam on a topic with a guest, if it's me and Will, or when I was on with Ben Ennis or something like that, you can just cut the guest short and just talk amongst yourselves. I got to get like 15, 20, 25 minutes out of everyone, or, like use the text line or callers or whatever to kind of get through. So it's more an adjustment from the prep side. But yeah, like in terms of how it actually operates, like it is like such a different energy where you can't play off of Will or Alex. You can't like if I don't have it that day, Alex can't pick me up, Will can't pick me up, things like that. So it's different, but it's not, you can't really like give that part of it, I don't think, conscious thought, because you just gotta roll with
Gotta
it.
do it. Just gotta do it. I guess with the Jays, and we alluded to them being pretty woeful to mediocre. I guess just like, where is this team going? Like, I it feels like it's just going into the pre-2015 Jays years where it was just 75, 80 wins, plucking along. Like, where do you see this team going? Not just like, it feels like this year is like maybe the breaking point where some big decisions will be made.
Yeah, some big decisions certainly should be made. The reality of the situation is, given the three wild card era, The bar to entering the playoffs is much lower. So if you're a team that's four games below 500 on June 20th, and you came into the season with expectations of making the playoffs, you're not going to pull the plug on that yet. I know fans want that, and you know, there's a you could intellectually make the case of, hey, blowing it up and trading Vlad and trading Bo and Gausman and everyone else is the quote unquote right thing to do. But there are counterexamples to that. There are teams that have pivoted on the fly and, you know, only had one or two bad years or dipped out of the playoffs for a year and got back in. Now, those teams also have managed better farm systems and spent their money in free agency, you know, maybe a little better. So then you get into the question of like, okay, well, if you're going to retool at the deadline for 2025, should this be the same guy doing it? So those kind of questions are ongoing. The bigger, you know, are they going to blow it up? Are they headed for like a multi-year rebuild? Like, I don't think they're ever going to accept the Orioles model of like for 5 years, we're going to be irredeemably bad. They have a whole bunch of new premium suites and a 40,000 person stadium with lots of renovations and 162 games of television and things like that. Like, it's also baseball more than in basketball. Like, you don't have to. Tanking is one way. The Orioles hit an absolute 100 percentile. Like, they did the Thunder model and they nailed every single thing. Look at how many NBA teams have tried to do the Thunder model. Like, the Pistons,
I know.
are the example you're afraid of. In baseball, it's more like, you know, maybe you're the Tigers where you're coming out of it now, but you're coming out of it and like fighting to be 500 and in the middle of the AL Central. So baseball, you know, like the Dodgers have been in the playoffs. This will be the 12th year in a row, and they've always maintained a top 10 farm system. The Yankees have a top 10 farm system. The Red Sox have dipped out a little bit and got their farm system back up from like the teens to like borderline top 10. The Brewers and Guardians make the playoffs most year. The Brewers, Guardians, and Twins are all like small market teams that have done the we're going to try every year, but we're also going to have a good farm system because the second anyone gets expensive, we'll wave goodbye. Like, you don't have to do the big teardown in baseball the way maybe it feels like you have to do in basketball, in part because like farm systems are so important. And also because, like, I don't know, say the Jays tank the rest of the year. Okay, they get the number 10 pick next year instead of the number 20 pick, which already isn't until next July because the draft is a year later. And then 5 years from now, that guy is maybe major league relevant. Like, it just doesn't work the same way. So the bigger questions are going to be about, are they going to trade some pieces with an eye toward 2025 being better? Whether you like it or not, whether I like it or not, that's what they're going to do.
And what do you think those players, and I know you've talked about it a little bit on your show, but just like what players might be dealt, and is there any way where if they, get a bit better that they maybe even add a little bit the way they've added?
Yeah, that's what the next kind of 4 weeks are about. So they got 20, as we record this, they got 23 games before the All-Star break. And the All-Star break's kind of unofficially when you have to make that decision because all the GMs will be out at in Texas at the All-Star game. And then you've got 2 weeks to kind of lock in a deal from there. So they've got about 23 games. They'd have to go 14-9 to get back above 500. And that's against like a really tough stretch of schedule. So they're going to give them that 23 games. There's not a, I don't see a ton of reason for optimism that things will suddenly change, but maybe they do. And then in that case, yeah, they'd probably be a mild buyer. They'd definitely look to add to the bullpen. They'd probably try to upgrade, you know, the Kiermaier spot and slide Kiermaier down into a true bench role, some sort of move like that. And then definitely bullpen help. If they are to sell, you know, the guys who are about to be free agents, the big ones are Kikuchi and Jansen. So you would have a big market for those guys. Rental market, to be clear, like you're not getting the Juan Soto package for either of those guys, but you could get a decent prospect or two back for those guys. The you kind of have Justin Turner and Kevin Kiermaier who are like, well, they're free agents and they're veteran bench guys. Like you maybe trade those guys just to get out of the money and like pick up a fringe prospect or something like that. And then yeah, if they're healthy at the time, Jimmy Garcia, Trevor Richards, that kind of guy. So those are kind of your impending free agent guys. You'd probably listen on some other guys just to see, but it's hard to like you're not getting good value back for Vlad, right? Bo is a bigger one. Maybe the Dodgers get desperate and like they have a really interesting top of the system or something like that. But for the most part, I think it's probably the guys, the Kikuchi Jansen types who are headed for free agency. And yeah, you don't get a boatload, but you can get years of control is this is an interesting difference between baseball and basketball, where like if a guy has more than 2 years left on his deal in basketball, a lot of times it's like, oh no, wait, whoa, that's bad money. Don't take on all that. And in baseball, it's like if a guy only has a year and a half left, I don't know, I'm not giving you all that much. It's funny how the timeline dynamics work like that.
Do you think it's just because in baseball you can sign longer term contracts? Is that, do you
I think
think?
it's also no salary cap. So there's like, you know, the opportunity cost is there in terms of your budget, but the opportunity cost isn't there in terms of like roster building flexibility, right? Like the Pacers giving Pascal that deal is real money. But like it's not as if the Pacers, unless Halliburton becomes like top three superstar, it's not like they were going to go out and spend that $40 million on a player better than Pascal Siakam, right? Over the next couple years. Whereas in baseball, you know, the payrolls are more flexible. There's no salary cap and stuff like that. Yeah, I think it's just a product of that.
Do you think do you think the Pacers should bring in three Monty Williams?
Oh, sorry. I also should say that baseball players make way less money than basketball players is another reason that that's the case too. They just make less, and that makes it all a little, it's easier to juggle 20 million than 40 million, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And yes, three Monty Williams for a Pascal Siakam deal is man,
Love it.
65 million to go sit at home.
That's crazy.
The
That
dream.
is the dream. You mentioned Bo and Vladdy, and I feel like people have talked about 2025 with them for so long now. What do you think happens? Either, you know, you alluded to it, maybe getting dealt with Bo, but still seems unlikely. Do you think that they're going to extend them this summer, like, or not this summer? Sorry, I'm used to basketball terminology in the winter. What do you think happens with both of them going forward?
Yeah, honestly, I don't really know. Like it's so hard because hey, sorry, my cat is knocking over all my equipment. It's hard because like this past offseason would have made no sense for Vlad to work out a deal, right? Like he's coming off the worst season of his career. He still probably wants that like 10-year 300 million number that was floated a couple years ago. The Jays aren't going to give him anywhere close to that based on his last couple seasons. So you would just be so far apart where Vlad would probably just bet on himself and say, you know what? I'm going to play out the year. I'll make 25 million through the arb process and then I'll see what's out there. You do a bet on yourself. With Bo, it's probably some element of that and some element of he's just like so underpaid relative to what he'd get in free agency next year that maybe if you're the Jays, you're okay running that through. Like obviously there's a impact of the cost certainty there and like not knowing if a guy could walk for nothing and things like that. But when you're in a competitive window, I think you worry about that a little bit less than if you're, you know, blowing it up or taking a step back or whatever. I don't know. I don't have this on like good, like this isn't reporting. This is just me speculating. But like, I do think it's easier to come up with a Bo trade scenario than a Vlad one, just based on value and what you could get back and stuff like that.
Is it we're now with this team? You talk about competitive window where that has been missed, and I think about 2021 and how they were so close, and that team felt like a World Series team, and even 2022, the collapse last year was just brutal as well. What is the path to become, you know, a contender, or is it just trying to be, you know, as you mentioned, the three wild card spots get in and then you never know? Is that the
Yeah,
future of the Jays?
it's tough because, you know, the goal wasn't to be one of those wild card teams, right? Like I make a joke sometimes on the show about the DePoto 53 model. And what that is like the Mariners basically said, our goal is to win 53% of our games every year. If we do that and that's our baseline, we'll make the playoffs a lot of years. And then like once you get to the playoffs, who knows what can happen? And that's like a that's a decent you shouldn't have said that publicly to your fan base. But for a smaller market or like a smaller spending team, that is a reasonable strategy in the current baseball environment. The Jays weren't supposed to be that. Vlad and Bo, and then when you add Springer and you sign all these free agent pitchers, all of that was supposed to be what takes you from like 2021 was supposed to be our introduction into the wild card picture and like into the playoff picture. We're a real team now. Hyunjin Ryu's here, Springer's here, our young guys are here. What happened after that? That was all supposed to be this is what's taking us to Yankees, Orioles, at the time Astros level. That was the goal, not this. So how they get back to being a wild card caliber team is pretty straightforward. Like, their guys start playing a little bit better. You hit on a bullpen guy or two, you get starting pitching health. Like, as bad as they've been this year, like 5.5 games out of the wild card, like, that's tough to make up now. But what I'm trying to say is they're not that far off from having been fine in the context of the playoff picture. So, like, getting back to that for 2025 is pretty straightforward. You got to have a better offseason than you had this past offseason. But mostly, your better players are better. Your pitchers are still good. Some of your young guys come up, and you hit on those fringe free agent signings better than you did this past offseason. The path to you getting to, like, Yankees, Orioles, Dodgers, Braves, Phillies kind of tier, like, that is way tougher. One, because two of those teams I mentioned are in your division, and even with a more balanced schedule, it's still tough. But the other is, like, that requires Vlad to not get back to being good. It requires him to get back to being a superstar. It requires Bo Bichette to get back to being a superstar, and the path that those guys were on toward that. And then you also have to hit on all those other things. And Davis Schneider has to be an above average regular. And one of Barger or Horowitz has to be a quality regular. And you've got to have someone other than Romano and Garcia back there. And, like, that gap is way harder to close. And that's not, like, I can see them very easily still, if this window ends in 2025, say, like, the path to them getting back into the wildcard picture this year is a little slimmer, but you could still squint and see it. Even if it's unsexy. Next year, no problem. They'd enter the season again, like, in the wild card mix. It's not that hard. Like, 9 teams are within 2 games of the wild card in the National League right now. It's not that steep a climb. But closing that more meaningful gap where you'd actually think you have a chance at a title that's a tough one. And I don't know, like, short of spending on Juan Soto, I don't know what the path there is, because, like, that guy isn't in the system. That guy isn't on the team, I don't think.
With that, you talked about Ross Atkins a little bit there. It feels like it's coming to an end. I'd hope, as a Jays fan, what, like, is there any chance that he stays? And if so, what will you think about his, legacy in Toronto and what he's done here?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he'll really have a legacy, honestly, which is, I think the way things have gone now, you'd probably just kind of fade into the background as, oh yeah, remember when that guy was GM? It's like if you're a Raptor fan, the success of the Ujiri era has kind of been like, oh yeah, there was a really funny couple years with Brian Colangelo. Yep. It's like, whereas before the I would say before 2016, when they went on that, like, the Colangelo era, like, defined the team's lack of success. So I think Atkins would kind of just, like, fade into being a figure like that. Like, damn, really missed the window. He didn't execute around the core as well as you necessarily needed to, and then, look, a lot of this in retrospect is going to also look on, well, Vlad and Bo didn't become what maybe we thought, and Springer, declined faster and things like that. It obviously, we don't see everything that goes on behind the scenes, but I look at a team that has a really high payroll, has a really poor farm system, doesn't have, and the guys that you do like in the farm system are deeper down, like, they're further away, at least on the pitching side. And yeah, some of that's injury stuff, but every team has had injury stuff. Like show me a team in baseball that doesn't have a pitching prospect on the IL right now. There isn't there. So you're very expensive. You've gotten kind of worse relative to your division mates year over year. You don't have a good farm system. I think you have the worst ranked farm system in the American League East. You've done a good job on international scouting and international signings. You've done a good job with free agent starters, but everything else is kind of a mixed bag to bad. I don't know how you could, if the season goes the way it's going and they don't make the playoffs, I don't know what the strength you point to is that says, hey, we're on the right path and we just got bum luck or whatever. I don't think, I think you could do that if you were a lower payroll team, or if the farm system was in good shape, or if the team was performing better. But they're kind of old. They're not that good, and they're really expensive, and they don't have a great farm. Like, that's a tough checklist for any franchise to be in right now.
What do you think, like, if you're whoever the next person that comes in, what would you do, like, this offseason?
Yeah, I mean, it's, part of that job is going to be figuring out on the draft and development side what hasn't clicked there, because this was supposed to be a strength of this front office. It was supposed to be something they did well. They have invested tons. I don't mean to say this to be like a Rodgers homer or anything, but like I talk to people around the league, like people come into town and I'll talk to, you know, players from other teams, coaches from other teams, media from other teams. And like everyone says, the Jays have like world-class facilities. It's the same in spring training. Apparently their Dominican complexes are like state of the art and class of the league as well, you know, short of maybe like the Yankees and Dodgers. So they're checking those boxes that the like capital investment stuff has worked. Why hasn't it resulted in, you know, a better farm system, hitters with higher upside? Like Aurelvis is the only, you know, high miners bat tool that has a big upside. They have a lot of these, like, hey, the hit tool's there and they have good swing decisions, but like they might not find a lot of power, or they don't have a position or something like that. And that's fine. Those guys are still useful. Like David Schneider was one of those guys. Addison Barger is like a Super Saiyan version of one of those guys. He's one of those guys that hits a ball 120 miles an hour every time. But yeah, anyway, this is all to say, like, they've done the investment part. They've done the international scouting side pretty well, but there's a huge question in like, why didn't the draft and develop process work the way that you anticipated with all these investments and stuff? And I mean, you kind of need to be inside to have that answer a little bit. And then from the main roster perspective, I mean, it's pretty clear that this team just is not built to with enough power to win the way games have to be won now. And that's, you know, in a lower scoring environment where the value of that home run is just so extreme. They kind of, if you were gonna be a lower home run team, you almost have to build like the Brewers and Guardians who we've seen recently, where you can run a lot, right? And I don't mean you don't have to small ball and like bunt with every time runners are on first and second and nobody's out or whatever, but you got to be able to put a little pressure on a team on the base paths, take the advance the extra base and stuff like that. You know, a lot of first to third hit behind the runner, that kind of stuff. They're just not, you know, they're not built to score in either direction. So that's probably what I'd address. You know, you would love to address the starting pitching depth. Every team would. But yeah, where they've come up short, you know, over the next little bit here, it might be more of a pitching issue because of the Manoah injury and just how thin the bullpen is right now. But yeah, if you're coming in, whether it's at the deadline or the offseason, it's the offensive side where there are gaps right now. And you've got, you know, you can't be a bottom five to bottom 10 offense in the American League East and expect to win 90 games. Like you just, I don't know, even if you like pitching and defense, which who doesn't, I gotta be able to run into one here and there too.
I want to transition as best I can from, you know, the Blue Jays mediocrity to maybe the Raptors mediocrity at the same point. At least they have Scotty Barnes. I guess that's a ray of sunshine. But when you covered this team throughout the year, they traded obviously Siakam and OG. I'm gonna ask you a pretty similar question, but like, how does this team get good? And is it more maybe they take a couple step back, like a step back or two the next couple years, and then try to, you know, maybe go Orioles style for a little bit of a cross matching in terms of references, and try to kind of bottom out, maybe get Cooper Flagg, and then kind of go from there. Where do you see the direction of the Raptors right now?
Yeah, it's you know, the Raptors at least have a benefit of, you know, clarity of direction at this point a little bit more, right? Like they made those trades. They let Fred go. They traded Pascal and OG. They're going to try to trade Bruce Brown at the draft or early in free agency. Like we know where they're headed. Now, whether they're going to do the whole Orioles slash Thunder style teardown, I don't think so. And part of that is, you know, RJ and Quickley. RJ's already on his second contract. Quickley's about to be. Those guys have 4 or 5 years in the league. Scotty's heading into year four and is going to sign that Supermax extension. That's good. That's fun, like to have those guys. But like you're talking about three guys who are entering kind of their early peak years, right? You don't want to wait to compete until they're on their third contract and are in their eighth year and stuff like that, because those guys might not want to stay. You might be, you know, talking about decline phase at that point if you're on the older end of that. So I think the Raptors probably want to compete again within the next 2 years or so. I think my guess is that this year they'll play it straight. They'll see how things go. If they're good enough to be a play-in team, cool. There's developmental value in a playoff race and playing meaningful basketball and stuff like that, even if it hurts the draft chances. And then, yeah, if they get out to a start where they're 10 games under 500 and you stub your toe, maybe we're going to give you a week and a half to rest that stub toe. Maybe there's going to be the key part for the Raptors will be that, like, you, and this was going to be the issue last year. And then RJ and Emmanuel quickly had their family tragedies and Scotty Barnes got hurt. But the hard thing about bottoming out last year was going to be you can't sacrifice playing time for 23 and 24 year olds. Like
No.
you can't not let Scotty Barnes develop so that you improve your lottery odds. That'll be the hard part. And the Raptors have to, within that, you can't come out of a season where like another bottoming out season where Javon Freeman Liberty on a two-way deal is like the prospect find you have. You have to do a little bit better if you're going to lean into that, getting some of the benefit of getting a look at other guys. And I know like Koloko had his blood clot issue
Yeah.
and Jontay Porter had his other issues. Like maybe those would have been two wins, but yeah, that you have to make a little bit more hay out of that situation.
How much do you know, for so long, it seemed like Masai and Bobby had that like fairy dust and everything turned into to gold. And that's kind of worn off the past couple years. How much trust do you have in those two guys right now? Do you think that, it's just been a couple, it's a tough job being a GM and president and finding those diamonds in the rough? Or is it maybe a decline in their maybe decision making?
I will say I have more faith in them than the other guy we were talking about.
One has a championship. Yeah, that helps.
Yeah, look, but Masai's front office, and this includes Bobby and Tolsman and Engelbrecht and Keith Borowski, everyone, and Teresa Resch before she went off to the WNBA. That's a big loss, and they're still trying to fill that hole. Like they're still going through that process, so that should be noted. But it should also be noted that, like, one of the things you worry about when your team gets good is brain drain, right? Like other teams are going to come and want to poach your front office people or your coaching staff. That certainly happened on the coaching staff side. They didn't really lose a lot of front office people though. Like they got by pretty okay on the front office side. So, I think there are a couple things going on. You can just run into a cold streak like Fred and Pascal and Boucher and those success stories. Like those are low percentage plays. So even if you're going to hit on some of them, but some of them aren't. I think there's also, you're seeing what I'll call a legacy cost from the championship, which is that you had way fewer picks. And even if you're very good at drafting, having fewer picks in the late 20s in the second round, you get fewer chances at it, right? Like let's say everyone else in the league is one in 10 chance of hitting on a second round pick. And you're like, we're so good, we're a 1 in 3 chance. Well, guess what? You had one second round pick over like 6 years, except for that one year where you traded TD and Matt Thomas for mid seconds. And you actually got Delano Banton out of that, which is like a pretty good outcome for a mid second round pick. Anyway, even if you are good at it, it's not like good at it means we're going to hit on 100% of second round picks. We're going to hit on an undrafted guy every year. So you had fewer opportunities there. Even like going to the finals, their process that year for evaluating draft prospects and stuff like that was way thinner than we're used to because everyone was on the road the whole time. It was all hands on deck. And like Jama was going back and forth, San Francisco to Toronto to do those draft workouts and stuff. But you can win and develop at the same time, but something has to give when you're trying to do every single thing really, really well. So I think it's a combination of those things. There was maybe a little period where the Vision 6-9 stuff got a little too narrowly focused. And like you saw that with the 905 for a couple years there too. This stuff's just hard though, honestly. Like I don't want to give them a free pass because like I haven't agreed with some of the moves. Like I thought they should have moved off of Fred when the signals were there, he could walk. I didn't like the Jakob Poeltl trade at the time, even though I really like Jakob Poeltl as a player, and as a dude to have around. I thought they maybe waited a little bit too long on the Siakam trade, where I'm still pretty sure you could have got a little bit more if you had done it in the offseason. I understand why all of those things happen, but I'm just trying to add the context here that I'm not giving them a free pass. I think there are things they've made mistakes on, but also like staying at that level for more than 10 years is hard. You're gonna mess some stuff up. They hit on the Scotty Barnes thing, which is the most important part. I think they did well in the OG trade. The Pascal trade.
Is OG returning?
Ha! I would love it. I don't know where they're gonna get the money.
Yeah.
You know, it would be man, I would pay a good amount of money to get a video of James Dolan being told the Raptors signed OG.
Yeah, that would be great. And just waving it up in front of the lawsuit as well, everything. With that, from I'm gonna go from Dolan to Scotty as best as I can here. Obviously he had a breakout year this year. And when you watch the playoffs this year and you look at like the big wings and Tatum Brown, and how do you think his game can kind of go translate to the playoff? You know, they might not make but the playoffs next year, but just in general, like, do you think his trajectory could be one of those one or two best players on a championship winning team?
Yeah, I think honestly the biggest takeaway from the playoffs is that like there is no like the idea of one guy is not really realistic, right? Like that Boston team spread Dallas out and stretched them so thin defensively that like that's what it wasn't because Jason Tatum was amazing. Jason Tatum was really good,
But
but it wasn't because Jason Tatum was really amazing or Jaylen Brown was really amazing. It was because they had a whole bunch of those guys and then a whole bunch of complementary players who can also dribble and attack and spread the floor and things like that. You know, even the Luka model, like they had really good rim running bigs who suited Luka and Kyrie. They had Kyrie. They tried to add some 3-point shooting at the trade deadline. Like there's a lot there. You know, Jokic has Jamal Murray and Aaron Gordon. So anyway, all that is to say, like nobody is going to do it without a really good team around them. In terms of, you know, what plays well in the playoffs, I think, yeah, versatility is the most important thing because you're going to run into, you know, especially at a time like this where we have six different NBA champions in the last 6 years and no defending champs made it past the second round. Like that parity means that a lot more of the playoffs is matchup dependent and how you match up with a certain opponent. And having a guy who's as versatile at both ends as Scottie Barnes is how you want to build, right? Like you don't, again, you don't need to go the whole everyone is 6'9" and can dribble and switch and stuff like that. But versatility is really going to be key unless you can blow everyone away with talent or you have the best player in the world in Nikola Jokic and a team built really well around him. You know, stylistic versatility is going to be really, really important. And I think Scottie Barnes is a guy who really lets you do that. Play some five as a screener and roller, play some point guard in bench units, play the wing proper, defend low on the floor, defend at the point of attack. Like those are the kind of guys where, you know, whether he ends up being like an okay number one or a really good number two, I'm not as worried with that because the Raptors just need to get more talent in the door anyway. They're at a talent deficit relative to the teams they're trying to compete against. But Barnes is, you know, the nice thing about Barnes is when you look at, well, who should they add next to him? Who complements him? His versatility really keeps you open to a lot of different options. So, yeah, I think he can scale to the playoffs. I think part of the reason they'd be okay with going to the play-in this year, even though the goal eventually is not the play-in, is get him some more reps like that. Let's see him as a number one in a playoff series. Let's let him learn like that because obviously you know, a playoff series and a play-in game. But it's different when you're the guy and things orbit around you. So, I don't know. I think that's exciting. I think that's an exciting part of this year, kind of continuing to figure out what makes sense around Scotty and, you know, RJ and quickly are obviously the important pieces there. But as you continue to round out and if you look for, you know, a co-star at some point, who makes the most sense? And I think Barnes's versatility lets you go in a few different ways there.
With RJ, you mentioned him. Just he played so well for the Raptors this year when he got traded to Toronto. How much do you think like that shooting, his efficiency that just spiked from his time in New York is real, and how much of it may be just a kind of end of season, new team, playing loose, not in New York? Just what do you make of his success to end the season?
Yeah, you know, I think it's important when it's half a season, what not even half a season, 30 games or whatever of shooting data, you know, you don't want to overreact to it. Like RJ had a whole season where he shot 40% on threes and then it went away for a little bit. It's certainly encouraging. I'm not going to pencil him in as a 40% 3-point shooter or 39% 3-point shooter coming into this year, but I think you can say, yeah, there's a little more shooting talent than the 3-point percentage in New York, suggested. In terms of him suddenly being lethal in the mid-range, maybe that's something you need to see a little bit more. But I think the most important thing when you're looking at something like that is where was the change in how he got his buckets? And I mean, one, he was a terror in transition. He's always been really good at that, but he took that to another level. And then you look at where he took his shots. 43% of his shots as a Raptor were at the rim, and he shot 73% on them. So this is a guy who we know has good downhill attacks against seams really well from the second side, will play out in transition. So that is a guy who should be able to get into the paint and score around the rim for you. The jump from 28, 29% in New York to 43% of your shots coming at the rim is huge. And if that sustains, RJ is a fundamentally different player because then like his shot diet is the high percentage stuff, right? And I don't mean this like analytically, like, oh, you don't take mid-range or whatever. The best shot in basketball is still a shot at the rim. If you're getting to the rim way more often and you're shooting 73% when you're there, and maybe 73% is a little high, but RJ is very strong. It's not unrealistic. He could shoot in the high 60s consistently at the rim. So that's the part to me that's really encouraging. And he did a lot of that with poor spacing. He did some of that, late in the season with
Not a
incoherent
lot.
lineups that aren't going to be what they're playing here. So that part's more encouraging to me than, oh, he got hot from three. I hope he shoots better on three, but that nose for the rim, that ability to get 2 feet in the paint regularly, whether on your own or just like taking advantage of what's there in the defense, that's huge. And it's a skill that the Raptors needed so badly last year.
Yeah, he's been so much fun to watch. With you talked about his partner in crime. I don't know if they're best friends, but they're very good friends.
They're
And
close, yeah.
yeah. What do you think his contract looks like this summer? He's obviously an RFA. Is it 100? Like I don't know. Like what do you think it kind of lands in around?
Yeah, it's a tough one. Like RFAs are always tough to nail down, right? Like it's I don't know. It's a weird one because on like you could easily see one team just being like, you know what, Emmanuel Quickley is the best available free agent who's not a max guy who we could actually sign, and they give him the mini max and that's it, and then the Raptors have to match. I don't think that's going to happen. I think if you got a deal that averaged out to 25, say, that's probably on the higher end of what you'd like to happen. But if that's what it is, then that's what it is. Yeah, I don't know. Like I know that there were comps thrown around when he was still in New York. So I think 4 years, 100 is like a reasonable baseline. I think the Raptors would love to get that for like 4 years, 90 or something like that. And you just kind of backload it with the rising cap. John Hollinger at The Athletic had it over 100, like closer to the 100 to 120 range on a 4 year deal. That's where like, that's still fine. I'm still signing that rather than letting him walk. But then you're like, you're already paying for the development at that point. Like that step you think Quickley can take, you're already paying for it. So he better take it. So I don't know. I think he's back no matter what. Like you don't make that you don't have him as a core part of the OG trade unless you think you're going to sign him. I think 100 is kind of the sweet spot of like, if you get something done at that or below, you're happy with it. If you have to go higher, you do it. And then you're just kind of like, oh,
That's a lot.
that's unfortunate, but you still have to do it. And then in terms of opportunity cost, the fact that he has such a low cap hold means you can do your free agent shopping and then come back and do that with him. So at least there's that benefit of like it doesn't eat up all your money this year. It's just kind of watching the tax once Scotty Supermax kicks in and Quickley's next deal and things like that.
What do you expect them to do in free agency? Just kind of is it, are we getting more Garrett Temples? Like what's happening there, do you think?
As a media person, I hope they get infinite Garrett Temples. Give me 18 Garrett Temples. Look, I think they will. I'm not the first person to say this. My read on it is that they will pick up Bruce Brown's option. If they are reasonably sure that they can find a trade spot for him, they would probably like to know that by the draft for sure. So maybe we get one of these deals that on draft night gets reported, but it doesn't get executed until
So
July 6th and the new cap year, whatever. I would be surprised, not even surprised, I would be a little disappointed if the plan is re-up Bruce Brown and head into the season with him waiting for a deal at the deadline. I think that's a possibility that they'd explore, rather than losing him for nothing. I don't love that option as much, because if you have Bruce Brown on the roster, then, it's either Gary's back as well and you use the mid-level, or Gary's gone and you're trying to replace Gary with a little bit more than the mid-level. I don't have my cap sheet open in front of me, but you can get to a lot of cap space if Brown and Trent are gone. If one of them is back, then you're trying to, you can always, and you could trade Boucher and create a little bit more space. You can always do stuff, but really the kind of tipping point number is that mid-level exception around 13 million. If you don't have significantly more than that in cap space after you bring back Gary or keep Bruce Brown or whatever, you're better off probably being an above cap team, using the mid-level, keeping those exceptions available to you, and that flexibility. You want a little bit of cushion there where you can outbid teams. Like, you can do what Indiana did with Bruce Brown and outbid the mid-level on a deal that maybe has some different team-friendly triggers and stuff like that. So you've got to be careful. It's just, if you bring back Bruce Brown and Gary Trent, and your roster looks the exact same, and all that you've added is a mid-level, and we know that mid-level gets you a back a good a high-end backup point guard, right? This year's Dennis Schroeder, Tyus Jones, Monty Morris, whoever it is. That's not a super exciting offseason, and this is the last offseason for a long time you're gonna have cap space. So probably if Scotty signs a super max, as we all expect.
Where do you see Gary Trent? Does it make sense to for him to come back? Like he shot well, but I don't know. It just
Yeah, I
doesn't.
mean, you can. Like, I'm not thrilled to go to 20 million for him, because I think that as and look, I should say he impressed me a lot this year. Like, beyond just the 3-point shooting, I thought from a leadership perspective, from a consistency perspective, he was really important to that team. I thought the defense ticked up toward the end of the year when a lot of guys would have probably, mailed it in, got their points, looked ahead to free agency. I thought he kind of kept guys hanging onto the rope, even though the results weren't there. I know the numbers were down overall, and the playmaking still hasn't come along the way we'd kind of hoped when he flashed at his first full season with the Raptors. But I think Gary Trent is a good rotation player. Like, I think he's probably worth about 14, 15 million. And if you pay him a little bit more than that to keep him, because it's awkward to decrease the salary from the 17 from the 18.5 he was making, whatever, I could live with it. But he's not a $20 million player. Like, at $20 million, I think he leaves, and you try to replace Gary Trent with the mid-level. And it's hard to find the next Gary Trent or the next Malik Monk breakout or something like that. But those guys pop, and sometimes they're guys late in the first round that can come in and score. And those guys won't be as good as Gary and won't be as reliable a 3-point shooter, not instantly. But like, Malik Monk was available for nothing a couple off seasons ago. It's on you to find that next guy rather than pay, overpay to keep that guy.
Grady Dick had a really good end to the season. Didn't play great to start, but it seemed like by the end he kind of was at the NBA level. How excited are you for year two? Where do you think he can maybe improve? Like obviously in a lot of areas, but what should be maybe his focus to improve upon next year?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is continuing the work on getting his body to an NBA level, and I don't mean that to like shame him or anything like that. He's a young guy who didn't come in physically ready for the NBA, and there's probably nothing he could have done to get there in one off season. But that's going to be a big thing, right? Like, he's got to defensively, he's never going to be a great defender, but if you are 6'6" with a good wingspan and you can get strong through your lower half and at least get in the way, and not be a zero, that's a really important step. That'll also help you. He's going to be asked to do a ton of movement off the ball, and that's a lot of running, yes, but it's also a lot of, brushing off guys, pushing off guys. A guy's going to try to get an arm in as you go around a screen. They're going to try to bump you off your spots. They're going to top lock you and things like that. Like, though, and we saw this year, he struggled. Even when he was playing well, he struggled against teams that had size and physicality. Like, I think it was the back-to-back against Orlando where, yeah, I just brought up the stats. He had 18 points over those two games, but only 2 assists. He was nothing on the glass. He was a minus 59 over those 2 games, and those weren't like blowout losses.
No.
Like those are the kind of teams that still, even when he was playing better, gave him some trouble. And he's gonna have to, continue to get stronger and get used to that. I think Samson Folk had a really great breakdown of all his off-ball verve
Yeah.
and why he's gonna be such a valuable weapon. And I think a difference this year will be unlike early this past year. He is established enough now, and he's gotten good enough that he's going to carry a threat and have value to you even when the shot's not dropping a ton, because other teams are going to respect him and they're going to chase him. But yeah, it's on him to kind of take that next level, I think, physically more than anything, because it helps you establish a floor a little bit. And like, I'm not as worried about like, oh, where's his handle at? Can he operate pick and roll? Like that's a like fourth year worry about it, to see if you can expand his role kind of thing. It's nice to have, but it's not where my focus is when we see Grady in camp,
Just I know you're not as locked in as you used to be for the draft, but is there anything do you think Bruce Brown gets you, like maybe not a lottery pick, but like a teens pick, anything about the draft that a player that you maybe want the Raptors to pick? If there's nothing there, that's okay. I'm just
No, it's fine. I mean, I am who I am. So I want done with the 31st pick. Like, I want another long defense first guy, a guy who, look, I full disclosure, I'm not, like you said, I'm not as locked in on the draft as I have been in past years. With the Jays duties, I can't dig into the tape as much.
Yeah.
So a lot of what my opinions are like regurgitating what Trey says, what Ben Pfeiffer says, what, Sam Vecenie and John Givony say, and things like that. But done as a guy who's probably the best defender in the draft and can't dribble or shoot, like, it's my
That's
guy.
your
Like,
guy.
I'm still looking for Andre Roberson,
I
and
know.
I want that in him. I think like you have Ochai already, so it probably doesn't make sense. But someone will pick him and I'll like him. It's interesting to see some of the like rumors, and you never know this time of year what's just noise, but some of the like high-end talent names that are potentially slipping in the draft. Like, that's where I get really interested about trying to use Bruce Brown to move up even a couple spots,
Yeah.
right? Is like, if Collier or pick your guy from the top five, Topic, whoever you like, if that guy slips into the back part of the lottery and suddenly, but you don't think they're going to get to 19, it's different. Bruce Brown's not going to let you trade into the top five. But if one of those guys is sliding into, 10, 12, 14, and you don't think they get there till 90, that's where it gets really interesting to me, is because I do think that my impression from what I've watched and from reading all these people is that while it is not the best draft at the high end, it sounds like some guys are sliding who shouldn't, like teams are overthinking it maybe a little bit. And in a flat draft, if those guys
You can
slide down the flat
draft them.
slide,
Yeah. OG.
there's maybe some opportunity there. Yeah, an OG scenario. Tyrese Maxey was a similar one, who I remember the like really smart draft people being like, why is this guy, like, you're overthinking it if this guy's sliding. And I've seen that stuff. I think this morning I was reading about Isaiah Collier
Yeah.
potentially sliding out of the lottery. And those are the kind of things where I think you have to be opportunistic if you're a team picking at 19.
Yeah, I'm gonna transition to Canada basketball because I think this might be the best for last, just because of how exciting it is. And I was with you. You were lucky enough to come on with me when Canada qualified for the Olympics, and now a year later, we can see the Paris on. I guess it's Lille actually where they're going to be playing the beginning of the tournament. But
Yes.
the training camp roster was dropped yesterday. Just what are your thoughts that essentially everyone showed up and. Do you think, like, I keep saying gold medal, I still think that's a possibility. How excited are you just for the summer and to see like everyone there and on the plane to Paris?
Yeah, very excited is the answer to that one. And in terms of the gold medal, yeah, I think you're doing a disservice to the talent and a disservice to the last 20 years of Canadian basketball on the men's side to get to this point, if that's not your goal. Like, we can be re realistic about it and say the US is a heavy favorite and even meddling would be such a huge accomplishment given the history of this program. Absolutely. But goal-wise and hope-wise, yeah, of course you're aiming for the gold. Like this Canada roster, and I know we all nitpick it, and it's like, where's Corey Joseph? Where's Tristan Thompson? Chris Boucher would look good on there. Oh, it sucks that Sharp and Mathurin are in camp, but not going to be on the team and stuff like that. And then you see American basketball media being like, Holy crap, what a camp roster.
Yeah.
So like that's, that's helpful context. And I think just, yeah, like the World Cup is a bigger, longer, more difficult tournament. And without a full 1000% squad, you won a bronze medal and you were not that far off from doing even better. I think it's completely reasonable to go in and be like, we're trying to win gold. And if you come home with bronze, you're very happy about that. You're happy about the progress. You're happy what it means. But you come out of that hungry then for 2027 and the World Cup. And I think that's really exciting. It's very, very nice. And this was like part of what was so special about the World Cup and qualifying for the Olympics is like we could drop the loser mentality stuff. And Canada basketball is not a like Canadian basketball fans don't have a loser mentality. The women's side has been good. We've seen the success in the NBA, but it was getting exhausting after 20 years of qualifying for something being the goal. Just showing up and doing well being the goal. It's nice to be moved on from that and be like, yeah, if you don't medal, this is disappointing. You should be aiming for the gold. The women as well. Like, I know that they barely qualified, but that was a team that was missing a lot of key pieces. They're of course in camp right now with their without their WNBA contingent. So we'll see what that roster looks like come actual Olympic time. But that's a program that's been really good for years and years. And I know that maybe at the very peak, it's a 2028 for them more than a 2024, but that's a team that is going to be, when we lay it out and rank them, they're probably going to be in the 3 to 6 range. So why not push for a medal? Yeah, probably the US is a foregone conclusion even more in that tournament, but why not push for a medal and make that the goal?
Do you think, like, just with them, at least for the men, and I think you said it with the women, like, I think USA is probably going to come back with a gold for the women, and they've been just so dominant in the women's Olympic tournaments over the years. But you look at Luka, Giannis, like, the game of basketball is so international. Do you think, in a sense, the USA is bringing the Monstars, but it's like the rest of the world's kind of caught up, and not just Canada, but everyone, and that almost plays to Canada's advantage in a sense, because it's not like the USA could only lose to Canada. They could lose to a bunch of other teams as well.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense if you're looking at this through the lens of, well, USA is the team you have to beat. However, if there are other teams that could beat the USA, that
That
means there are
is,
other really good teams that you have to beat. And you're gonna have a tough pool, right? Like
they'll
we're
be.
gonna see maybe Spain come out of that one, maybe Giannis and Greece come out of one. And then suddenly your pool looks really tough, and maybe a third place finish in your pool doesn't get you through because of point differential, because your pool's too deep. Whereas the other two pools, are maybe tougher to win, but have one team that you can beat up on a little bit, right? And pad your point differential. So, yeah, the more good teams, yeah, it's likelier the US loses that somewhere along the way, but that also means more threats to you. So, look, the US is going to be the favorite. There's no way around that. They're a little old. They've lost before. There's no, I don't know. I don't think you can have a healthy respect for them. You don't need to get big brothered by them before they big brother you. Like let them do it to you before you kind of concede to them.
I'm not too worried that SGA and Jamal Murray will be, scared to play against LeBron and them. I guess with that, like, who's your starting five? Ball tips,
Yeah,
everyone.
honestly, it's probably a little dependent on opponent because I think that Shai and Jamal are an obvious two. And then two, I'm probably starting small, and two of Brooks Dort and RJ are starting. It depends a little bit on the opponent, though. Like if you're against Luka or Giannis, I want Dort in the starting lineup. I'll take the offensive hit, hope he gets hot from three. But Dort, and I know Brooks is a good defender, but the gap between Dort and like everyone else when it comes to a Giannis or a Luka, I think you got to take the offensive hit and start him. And then probably Kelly at the five, and you use Powell off the bench. You can always flip those if defensively you're worried about, the rim pressure or something like that. But that's probably how I do it. It's just deciding which two of RJ, Brooks, and Dort get the nod there. How do you have it? Do you have it similar?
I have Wiggins. I don't have Wiggins. I have Powell at the five. I have obviously Shai and Jamal, and then it gets a bit kind of icky for me. And I went with RJ and Brooks. But
Yeah.
I think the question mark for me, and I don't know how you feel, is just where Wiggins goes. I
Yeah.
keep, I'm like.
Honestly, I think he's, and maybe you can sell him on this, but like he's Olympic Melo to me, man. Like that's got to be the role. Like you're
Yeah.
a undersized power forward. We need you to bang some threes. We need you to be physical. 'Cause like you look at this roster, it's great that Trey Lyles is there. That really fills a hole, but like this team is so much deeper when it comes to ones, twos, threes than they are at the 4-5 spot. Someone's and Wiggins is on the bigger end. Like RJ can do it a little bit because he's strong. Dylan and Dort can do it probably defensively, but you're gonna need like you're not using Wiggins as a two guard, right? Like with the
No.
ball in his hands a ton. You need him to be that kind of like a super end three, like Aaron Gordon-ish kind of, right? Like that's I think the role where he could really, really help this team.
Yeah, no, I think that's, but it just, I keep thinking about their bench and who you have off it. And then you have Nembhard, who is so good.
Yeah. I mean, the nice thing is like you could split the point guard and shooting guard minutes, just Shai, Jamal, and Nembhard. And then you obviously have N'Keal around as well, but you could do just those three, and that covers your two. And then your minutes at the three and the four are Brooks, Dort, RJ, and Wiggins. Like you could really, and you could keep guys fresh. You could sub a lot. You could not worry about fouls that much because you have those guys. And then Kelly and Dwight as your five. Like that is a nine-man rotation right there. And there are probably guys you're like, what about this guy? What about that guy?
Yeah, like Trey Lyles. I still wonder if Melvin Ejim gets it or Zach. I feel like Zach Edey, I don't know with the being drafted.
It's gonna depend who he gets picked by. Like I know he wants to play, but some teams are gonna be like, do you want a contract?
Yeah, exactly. I'm just so excited, and it's gonna be such a fun time. And I'm getting goosebumps, and I'll be there in Vegas for Canada.
Nice.
I say, and that'll be fun to see Dylan Brooks own LeBron. I think that would be a fun little one. I guess just before I let you go, is there anything you want to plug? You have a billion different things on, but obviously Jay Talk Plus happening these days. Just, thanks so much for doing this. I'm excited to follow you with the Jays, but also obviously Canada basketball soon. And I know you'll be as locked in as you can be too.
Yeah, I don't like full disclosure. I don't really know what I'm doing yet, if anything, because like the games are CBC games, right? So it's Shulman and Megan McPeak and Nabil Kareem on the call, which is we're so lucky. What an unbelievable crew,
I
and that's
know.
for the men's and women's. Yeah, and then I don't know. I got to sit down with the schedule and see which ones overlap with my show. Like last year, I was like very clearly watching World Cup games
I
during my Jay
remember.
show, and at least this schedule skews a little more like afternoon and night, so I'll be able to obviously watch it and stuff like that. But it's not about me. But I mean, I'll get the itch to do something. I'll at least be tweeting about it, and I don't know, bugging Dan for inside information from Paris.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this. Is there anything you want to plug for Jay's Talk Plus, or just kind of?
Yeah, I mean, it's on 10 to 12 every day, the podcast, whatever.
You got it. We got
Yeah.
it.
If
We
you don't
love
know
you.
where it this is the third season of it. If you don't know where to find it, you don't care for my you don't care to hear my baseball stuff. So
I guess
we're fine.
my last question is, what is your favorite sport? How do you define that? I feel like that's a loaded question for you, Blake.
Yeah, I mean, I love basketball and I love baseball. I don't
Equal love,
really
equal.
like Yeah, and like obviously more of my career's been basketball, and the highs in basketball have been tremendously high. My job is primarily radio, and I do think baseball is like a little bit more conducive to having a daily radio show, whereas basketball, my strength was like clearly on the writing side, not the radio and podcast side when it comes to basketball. So it's just different. There are different ways to enjoy it, and like the great thing is like they overlap a little bit, but and so like I'm not. Again, I'm not at the draft, I'm not at summer league, I'm not at training camp, but I can do enough of both that I don't have to choose. They will choose at some point, I probably, but for now I love them both. And if I'm on a basketball podcast, I love basketball more. And if I'm on a baseball show, I love baseball more.
What do you think your how cool would it be if both those teams won in the same year for
Yeah, it would be probably impossible for me to do both jobs. Like the only reason I can juggle both of the shows right now and both of the roles is because neither team has gone very deep. Like there was a contingency last year for the Raptors show where like I don't join that show for a while if the Jays go on a World Series run and then I need some downtime after whatever.
It's two games.
Yeah, and then like we were able to start, we started JayStock Plus way earlier this year than the last 2 years because the Raptors didn't even make the play-in. So, yeah, it would be very awesome. I don't think either team is super close right now.
2028 or something, we'll get it done. Scotty Barnes and
Yeah.
Vladdy Junior Junior or something like that. But
Aurelvis.
yeah, there you go. Well, thanks so much, Blake, for taking the time and doing this. I know you're a busy guy, and I just love your work, and we'll be in touch, and thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me, man.